a taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene. Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning, I'm Tina Janoukas. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. 3CR broadcasts from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. Today on the program, I have Jennifer McKenzie, no stranger to 3CR audiences. We'll be speaking about her latest collection, The Wallace Line, a poem, published by Transit Lounge. Jennifer has composed a marvellous, complex collection that spans centuries of European colonialism in Southeast Asia, the desert roots of Central Asia, and the figures trapped in European imaginings of foreign places. The collection also offers a remarkable poetic reimagining of the Wallace Line, that invisible boundary separating Asian from Australian flora and fauna. Jennifer, welcome back for another discussion about your extraordinary engagement with our region and beyond in this new collection, The Wallace Line, a poem.
Thank you very much, Tina. I'm very pleased to be here again.
Your new collection, The Wallace Line, a poem, is an ambitious work in four parts. It spans centuries of European colonialism in Asia from the 1600s onwards. Could you read Votive Offering, the prologue poem, and tell us when you realised the work needed to be a long, layered poem rather than separate pieces?
Votive Offering. That time in Jogja, the hotel balcony on Sosra Vijayan, rain thick as a curtain, the sugared tea sweet as. Tonight we'll go and dine at a hotel for the rich, then I'll wrap you in yards of spun cloth. I'll take you back east to the one who called your name as he built your true forest home. We'll stay there, among the ruins, till our fingertips can no longer bear it. I'd had an interest in the Wallace Line, I'd say, for over 10 years particularly, which goes back to seeing a painting by John Wolseley at the Australian Galleries here in Melbourne. And this was a huge painting. It was a map of Australia and some of Indonesia with migrating birds flying across the continent. And I think this connected very much to the work I'd done on Borobudur and the ideas of space and continents, connections between places, all those kind of things that have, you know, sort of stimulated my imagination over a very long time. So I think the Wallace Line, in a way, kind of connected to those kind of themes. But when it comes to this book, the way it appeared wasn't initially to be such a large scope. It was more to be focused on eastern Indonesia and Wallace. However, what really, I think, connected everything was going along to a performance of the Australian Chamber Orchestra of the Four Seasons, and they had Joseph Tuadros playing the oud. There was a lot in their catalogue, actually, about connections with Venice, the spice trade, musicological connections. And I think that's when it really sparked, that I could see that I could make poetic connections. It's not a book of history as such, but I could make poetic connections across space, and that was really exciting.
It's interesting you mention Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, because that runs through the book as a feigned kind of musical note, if you like. But also the book is in four structures, which kind of mimics, doesn't it, the Vivaldi's Four Seasons?
Yes, that's true, yes.
Could you read the first poem in the Banda sequence from the first section of the book, and tell us what drew you to the heartbreaking history of the Dutch colonial system in Indonesia.
Banda, 1. And we had sailed and sailed to here be dragons. We came to shore late morning, and looking up into a thickly wooded panorama, we saw placed among it the white glow of glorious Pukenea housing. Their pillars and gaudy casements looking out, as the poet said, on a rich man's flowering lawns, his planted hills. And at one such dwelling a banquet in preparation, and aroma of spices packed into fresh caught perch gushing from the brazier. Along a path to the slave quarters, bondsmen and bondswomen brandishing bamboo nutmeg pickers, reaching high to the canopy of flourishing canary trees. And the drying room, near as tall as those trees, towered above. Great flames leapt to the brazier, men balancing on a high platform, taking the nuts to the drying trays, and men laden with sacks carried this black gold to the port. It was cool under the trees, almost cold. We shivered, a damp breeze. It is the presence of the anguished, said our guide. My interest in this part of Indonesia really took off when I was in Makassar at the Writers' Festival there, going down to the port, well, this was 2013, and seeing all the Bugis boats, the colourful boats, the different kinds of peoples out that way, astounding variety of people. My interest was really sparked by the Indian writer Amitav Ghosh. Ghosh has written a lot about the oceans and shipping, themes of colonialism, and he's particularly interested in environmental effect of colonialism. In The Nutmeg's Curse, he looks at particular islands, in this case Banda, was at one point the only place where nutmeg was grown. It was a very valuable commodity. For centuries, trading was done with different groups, Chinese, Indian, Middle Eastern. But with the coming of the Europeans, of course, a monopoly was their focus. The Dutch, through a group of mercenaries under Jan Pieter Zoon Koen, committed genocide on Banda. Approximately 90% of the population were murdered. I hadn't heard of that before I read Ghosh's book. So that became a focus for the book.
And that is a very heartbreaking event.
Yes. Ghosh recounts a story that there's a well, and it's that the ghosts of those murdered dwell there. So in the Banda poem, that's the reference in there to these voices and so on.
Could you read Maluku Prismatic and tell us how you fused your Southeast Asian experience with historical research?
Maluku Prismatic. The colour is luminous here. Memory is of pastel, blue, pink, lemon robes in the marketplace. Dwellings, a slash of yellow and mauve, a constellation of red roofs, dimming only for star showers. On a clear night, clove, nutmeg, and the boats came. Would they tip off the edge of the earth, that edge sharp as glass? The volcano broods like a giant cat. Wallace's bird's wing butterflies ablaze on a hot tropical day. Storm clouds coming on the day of the knife. Kaleidoscope of fluttering tangerine wings. The deaths were silent. Perpetrators, Here in the shadow-rich square, the blood sacrifice lingers. A howling of hantu, flick of a presence over the shoulders, a gossamer of spiders.
That's such a beautiful poem. Behind it lies a lot of research.
Yes, there's certainly the gauche aspect. Wallace too, because while I was thinking of this poem, I was thinking also of his discoveries and the kind of natural world that was there represented. I think in this one there's quite a bit of imagination coming into play in terms of the colour, as well as, you say, the research. You have such sense of what this place looks like, that there is a lot of colour, which I employed, I suppose, as a kind of contrast to this horrific event. So, yes, it's a kind of mix, as you say, of the sensory and that kind of research too.
And that happens throughout, you know, the beautifully constructed poems, the imagery is rich and yet very solid research behind them.
Yes, I think when I first started writing about Indonesia, you sort of became aware that you needed to know something about it, that to go along as a foreigner and just write something is not a very satisfying experience for anybody, the poet or the reader. I do love to do that, to find and bring in actual history or facts or observations into the whole thing.
Could you read Venice and tell us what the city symbolises in the book?
Venice is from a section called Souk, and Souk is the market. A palazzo can evoke those heady days of trade and seawater, buzz of pastoral and tempest, dripping from the walls of a masterpiece of churches. Marco Ricci, sfumato, ignites, casts a palpable excitement to the surface of the waterways, a lapping at crystal high tide. Seasons dazzle, the orphan's bow a buoyant scoring. Vivaldi skips, knows he's on to something. With this one, I was thinking of Venice. By the time of Vivaldi, its days as the preeminent sea power was slightly behind it, but the history was there, the architecture, the art. Within the context of the ACO and the Four Seasons, I was thinking of influences coming in from the East and from the West as well. I'm imagining Vivaldi responding to this environment, and apparently Ricci was quite an inspiration for the Four Seasons. Somehow this idea of art inspiring him, which is something that interests me a lot, comes into play. I think it's a kind of motif that carries across the collection, that there's snippets of art which transform in other ways, in other settings.
Yes, there's also the suggestion, or one could make the interpretation, that you're also critiquing European appropriation of cultural forms from other places.
Yes, obviously there's a lot of debate about that kind of appropriation, but I think in some way there can be, as far as art goes, there can be a working with different forms, so that what can come in one direction can also come from another. It's a more complex situation than is often given.
Yes, because there's an exchange going on.
There's an exchange. Mm. One of the themes of the book is about borders, and with a lot of borders then problems occur. Exchange between cultures can be very rich. However, of course, we know the downside.
Become a subscriber and support Radical Radio. Call 03-9419-8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas. You're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today, I'm speaking with Jennifer McKenzie about her new collection, The Wallace Line, a Poem, published by Transit Lounge. Jennifer, could you read Alien Cole Corn, the Silk Road section, and tell us what drew your attention to the contemporary ecological exploitation of this particular trade route?
Alien coal, corn, air pollution, the black humour plan, dig for coal in the West. But ruefully, said the Greenpeace activist, coal swallowing water like a demon who knows only thirst. Shrinking water table. Somewhere on the road, between Kola and Akshu, a metre-wide oasis, bubbling brook, a blaze of sunflowers, lush, sprightly corn, a soft buffeting breeze, a boy there, and the iron rocks of the wasteland telling you it is us and only us. Well, this poem came from when I was fortunate enough to take a trip along the old Silk Road some years ago. And as you drive along for hour after hour through this desert, then on one occasion suddenly appeared this oasis. And there's a kind of contradiction along the way. At one point there's a absolutely extraordinary wind farm going along, and you also find solar panels and things in areas that don't have half the sunlight that we have in Australia. So there's this kind of drive towards environmental concerns, but at the same time madly digging for coal in the same area, which is really not set up for it due to the shortage of water and so on.
Could you read Sailing from the Modernist section of the book and tell us what figures like Joseph Conrad, Antonin Artaud and Rimbaud represent in your unravelling of early 20th century visions of Southeast Asia?
Sailing, with an epigraph from Calvino, I love Conrad because he navigates the abyss and doesn't sink into it. He that was formed out of the icy gulag of exile, that remedy was to sail. Languages steeped in deep jungle formed the heart. Composing English to the strength of what he fashioned, but the tales of others were best. The leisurely chat at dockside, beers and tobacco, the yarn cloaking the cruel red-faced bluster of European thieves. It was English that laced the forests and waterways, the sailors' homes, the beer and rum spiked with cigar ash. English flooded the yarn, a polyphony of sorts. The immensity of sea and sky, actors mining duplicity or not, the flawed watchful in his presence, set for a fall. Marlowe, Tiresias, I, Ganesha, I, Marlowe, set for a fall, and at the source of the river, dark foliage, a fiery sun, monkeys chattering on water's edge, all saying, continue in, to be flung, lover of trees, to be torpedoed at mad pace, the body rising, embracing sapling and bark, skin shedding all memory, a disgrace pocketed. Yes, the Achilles' heel in the slime, a welcome in weed and bog. Oh, Jim, dominating the page, the furtive estuary, I, the author, walking down Collins Street, I had never felt so alone. J.C., 1888. Try early morning, a Sunday, Elizabeth Street, 1969. One furtive cafe open, a light blinks above its bain-marie. In a way, I think this whole book is a kind of representation of my poetics. And so on one level, the modernism section is indicative of that, this kind of my history that where Ezra Pound and imagism and so on is crucial to my style of writing. And I think Pound's interest in China, in a sense, was something that propelled me in a way when it went back to old Javanese literature, which is also very highly imagistic. And other influences have come to play on that level, which is why, on one level, Conrad, Artaud and Rimbaud are included in this. For example, Artaud has a wonderful essay which he wrote on gesture in Javanese dance, which I think is kind of key to a lot of my work. And Conrad I've been reading since I was about 16 and think a lot of him. I think he's a very interesting, complex writer.
But you seem to be doing more than that. I mean, you're not simply re-presenting what we already know about these figures. It seems to me that in this section, you're in some ways undoing, you know, European fantasies, even of what these writers were engaged in.
Oh, yes, that's true. So it's not like a fan club section. But I suppose in a way it kind of interrogates my own interest. It interrogates their interest. And it's a kind of commentary. You know, some people have asked me, you know, my greengrocer actually, who's a great fan of poetry, every time we go there we have a good chat, and he asked, you know, whose voice is this? Is it your voice? Is it the voice of the writer? Is it Wallace? Is it Conrad? And so I think in a way it's an embodiment of these kind of questions that you mention. So it's not saying, oh, these are jolly good fellows, but they interest me because, you know, as they've done for so long. But the whole book, I think, is a kind of questioning and interrogation of these kind of perceptions and how it could be viewed, you know, from many different kind of angles.
The Wallace Lyons section of the book forms an ecological and scientific boundary, but also an imaginative one. Could you read Trepang and tell us how this section speaks back to European imperialism and visions of Southeast Asia?
Trepang, in memory of Lily Yulianti Farid. And we came to the bustling streets of M. We spied among the crowd tall, curly-haired men, decorated with a design unknown to us, and drenched in a vermilion sunset so wondrous it seemed a blessing from heaven. We returned to the port dense with the majestic Phoenici, and we were told they were Trepang traders, dwellers on a coastline far away, an immense country beyond imagination and with animals as if from an almanac. What kind? Hopping deer, laughing birds. This poem, Trepang, there's been a huge amount of research done on the trade between northern Australia and eastern Indonesia, in particular Makassar. And it's in this poem I was dedicated to Lily Yulianti Farid, who was the first director of the Macassar Writers Festival. And she was part of a ongoing research team at Monash looking at these encounters with the Yolngu people from Northern Australia. Researchers discovered that some of those people actually settled in Macassar and raised families, and the descendants are living there. So I thought this was a good way to finish the section because it's extending trade to Australia, that there are exchanges, that were going on and banned, of course, by the government here. This trading had gone on for hundreds of years, and I think it was 1907 that it was banned. So there'd been these connections for a long time. And so the Wallace line part is rich in these kind of exchanges, both good and bad, so that a figure like Wallace, who did extraordinary work in observation of birds and butterflies and making the extraordinary discovery of this line, which had never been, you know, actually presented before, it's an incredibly rich kind of exchange, as I say, good and bad.
You were recently at the Ubud Writers Festival where you presented this book. I would love to know what the reaction there has been to this book.
Yes, well, I was extremely pleased that a few people came up to me, and people who'd bought the book, they were saying that it was easy for them to read. When I was actually writing this, I thought, is it going to be clear? I really wasn't sure if it would, you know, that people might say, what are these connections? You know, what's going on? But I was surprised that people seemed to find it very accessible, and they liked it because there were places they knew that they could connect with. And it was a very lovely response from a number of people. It was really nice.
Let's go out on the final poem of the collection, which is the epilogue poem, Li Mingwei, The Moving Garden.
Li Mingwei, The Moving Garden, for Tess Rice. The flowers pour in from the market gardens, rest in a gentle spiral in the trough. The artist requests that a viewer pluck a flower, take some circuitous route to their next port of call, and gift the bloom to a stranger. Such momentary intensity of the chance encounter? Or could the flower go to another artist, the photographer, revealing her creations to the world this very afternoon? Somewhere else the painter exhibits in a building up for demolition, portraits segue into the ruins, the dim light from high windows beaming into the shadows, catching red in the spotlights. Could it too carry the gift of the floral?
Thank you, Jennifer, and congratulations on what is an astonishingly rich poetic collection.
Thank you very much, Tina.
I'm Tina Janoukas, and you've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I've been speaking with Jennifer McKenzie about her new work, The Wallace Line, a poem, published by Transit Lounge. Spoken Word broadcasts every Thursday at 9 a.m. on 855 AM, or you can download the podcast. Jennifer McKenzie's The Wallace Line, a poem, is available online from Transit Lounge. Thank you for listening.